Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
The FT.
Will it get harder to get a credit card? And if it did, would that be such a bad thing? Buy-to-let is booming again, but will future returns live up to past ones? And how to make money from our love affair with animals? Welcome to The Money Show, one of the FT's most popular podcasts. I'm Jonathan Ely, and I'll be giving you all the money news this week in downloadable form, with the help of my FT colleagues James Pickford, Adam Palin, and a special studio guest, Jane Tully of Money Advice Trust. Let's start with an amazing statistic. Britons own 70% of all the credit cards issued across the whole of Europe. We spend £150 billion using them every year. For many of us, credit cards are a convenient way to spread spending, enjoy extra consumer protection, and earn rewards. But for far too many of us, credit cards are an expensive financial millstone. Fresh from beating up the payday lending industry, the Financial Conduct Authority is now turning its attention to the credit card market, which it says does not always work in consumers' best interests. The regulator is particularly concerned about the complexity of credit cards, the fairness and transparency of their terms and conditions, and whether it is easy enough to switch providers. The FCA also plans to look into the ways in which cards are marketed, amid fears that consumers are browbeaten into taking them by continual mail shots telling them they've been pre-approved. So what sort of a credit card market does the FCA want? And is it going to happen? Well, let's ask Jane Tully, who is Head of Insight and Engagement at the Money Advice Trust. Jane, first of all, back to that amazing statistic that we own nearly all three quarters of all credit cards in Europe. Why do we have so many? How did we get to the point we're at now?
I think you're right. That 70% statistic is quite fascinating. And I guess one of the things that we hope that the FCA review will do is look at the market and look at international comparisons to understand the regulatory framework in this country and also the operating environment comparative to other places to help us get to the bottom of some of that figure. But in terms of understanding why we have such a big credit industry here now, I think it's useful to go back to 1997, because it was from that point onward that we've seen a massive expansion of the credit market. So since then, the amount outstanding has been massively in excess of the amount that's being paid back on a monthly basis. And at the same time, we've seen growth in the number of providers, so a shift from it just being the traditional banks providing products to new providers entering the market. And also between 2000 and 2010, I think we had 34 new entrants in total to the market. If you think about it, we have 200 credit cards in circulation now, so a massive expansion in the provision side of things. In terms of the number of cardholders as well, if you think about it, by 2013, we now have on average 2 cards held by each credit card holder. So a huge expansion there, and helping us to kind of understand more of the reasons behind that is something that we hope will come out from this review.
Do you think that's what the FCA is trying to achieve, in a sense that it's saying that this market has just got too big for its own good? A bit like payday lending, where you're now seeing the number of providers contract very sharply.
Well, the FCA took on responsibility for consumer credit regulation back in April. And since then, they looked at the high cost short-term credit market, and we know that's been quite a high profile review. They also expressed at that time an interest in looking at the credit card market, because that is one of the largest areas of unsecured lending under their remit. If you think about it, 30 million consumers, 57 billion outstanding balances. It is certainly an an area that the regulator needs to kind of understand all of the detail of in terms of the drivers for consumer behaviour, but also the incentives that, that firms would look at.
You mentioned that $57 billion is the sort of amount outstanding there. I mean, for how much of that is kind of problem debt, where people really are struggling every month and they're just rolling over balances and not really clearing any of them?
Well, I think the problem debt arises when people effectively revolve their credit payments from month to month. So instead of making the full payment at the end of each month, they roll that over, not just by 1 month, but by kind of several months. And then they're regularly making just the minimum payments on their bills. That's certainly a signpost to us that someone might be facing financial distress. At National Debt Line, we see this firsthand. So if we were to look at the kind of the profile of our callers, about 50% of them call us to do with their credit cards being in arrears. The interesting thing we've seen on that is a shift and a trend in that in recent years. So it was far greater back in 2007. We had 7 in 10 people call us with concerns about credit card arrears. Now that's only 5 in 10. I think the interesting thing we're also seeing at the same time is an increase in the number of concerns we have from people in terms of paying their household bills. And of course, you know, our concern then in relation to the credit market would be, are people using their credit cards to get by from month to month?
You mentioned that improvement since 2007. I mean, is that down to things that the industry has done? I mean, the UK Cards Association, in its response to the FCA probe, said that, you know, they talk about their commitment to responsible lending and transparency. And they say they've made a lot of changes over the last 5 minutes to things like credit limits and repricing of debt. Is that working? Are you seeing that having a positive effect?
I mean, we certainly think that some of that is working. We work very closely with the UK Cards Association, and for example, we've assisted them with the wording of some of their letters about meeting those minimum payments, and we've also helped out on certain codes of practice. I think the industry has its own body and kind of organisation now to help establish what some of those minimum standards are, and it may be that some of the outcome from the FCA review is about improving some of that self-regulation within the industry.
And finally, Jane, if the market does contract, will that penalise sensible users, those people who use credit cards responsibly, pay off their outstanding balance in full every month, and generally find them sort of useful products? Is there a danger that we'll throw the baby out with the bathwater here?
Well, we'd certainly hope not, because we know that credit cards are a really valuable tool for a huge number of consumers. And, you know, as we say, the market does work very well for many. So it helps people get through on that, you know, when your income isn't necessarily meeting your outgoings, and just get through those kind of unexpected costs or unexpected payments that you have to make. Our real concern is for those people who perhaps are over-borrowing on their credit cards, or perhaps there are incentives there that are encouraging them to do so.
Thank you very much. That was Jane Tully, Head of Insight and Engagement at the Money Advice Trust. Still to come on the show, we spend a fortune on our pets, but is there money to be made from our often irrational devotion to animals? First, though, let's take a look at the investment story of the past decade, buy to let. It's about 18 years now since someone first hit upon the idea of creating mortgage products specifically aimed at allowing individuals to become landlords. Since then, a combination of easy credit and rising house prices has resulted in over 1 million landlords, many of whom regard their property or properties as an integral part of their retirement planning. The introduction of new pension freedoms next April is expected in some quarters to fuel another wave of interest in bricks and mortar as an investment. Returns in buy-to-let can come from the rental income or from a rise in a property's value, or some combination of both. But with the pace of house price appreciation now seeming to slow, will today's wannabe Rigsbys ever be able to match the stunning returns achieved by earlier investors? Will a future government cut back on the generous tax breaks extended to amateur landlords? Will new mortgage rules from Brussels or rising interest rates make financing more difficult? And is this very hands-on form of investment suitable for everyone? James Pickford has been looking into the rise of the amateur landlord. James, early investors have done very, very well out of buy-to-let. We interviewed Fergus and Judith Wilson earlier this year, who have, of course, made hundreds of millions from their empire of properties. But are we in danger here of sort of extrapolating recent success out indefinitely and assuming that it will always be a great deal?
Well, very much so. I think what aspiring investors in buy-to-let have to look at is, as you've already mentioned, there are two sides to this equation, the capital value side and the rental side. And of course, the story of the past decade has been this extraordinary rise in capital values, particularly London and the South East, which played so well for the Wilsons, who are based in Kent. That appears now to be flattening off. Even this week, we've had figures from the BBA, which represents banks, showing that the number of mortgages lent have fallen by 16% in the past year. And Halifax is now predicting house prices will rise by as little as 3%. It said in the range of 3-5% next year, compared to a peak of 10% in July. So these investors can't expect the kind of stellar returns from the property itself, just owning the property. And therefore, they have to take a much closer look at whether it will earn the kinds of rents that will not only allow them to pay back their mortgages, but to cover maintenance and legal costs and all sorts of other costs and make a profit on top of that.
Mm-hmm. And what's the outlook for rents? I mean, presumably it varies very much according to whereabouts in the country you are.
Yes, rents have been rising and there are regional variations. At the moment, London, because its house prices are so high, the rental yields are not as good as elsewhere in the country, particularly East Midlands, the West Midlands, in the region of 6-7% compared to 4% for London. But there are reasons to think that it's a good play in the long term because of population change. The population is rising and the shape of the workforce is changing in that we have an increasing number of graduates. Young people tend to rent. And so over the long term, and bear in mind that the average buy-to-let investor does keep their house for 10 to 20 years, 2-3 market cycles, that they can have a reasonable chance of seeing demand for rents and rents rising over that period.
And the new mortgage regulations that were introduced in April do not apply directly to buy-to-let mortgages, but they are still having an impact on the rental market, aren't they?
Quite right. It's harder for people to buy a house now because they have to pass tighter regulations on whether they can afford to pay back the mortgage. And that means that particularly young people or people on low incomes, it's much harder for them to be able to buy a property, and therefore it pushes them towards renting.
Now, the Labour Party has talked about sort of rent controls of some kind if it is elected next May, but there's perhaps a more pertinent threat coming from the direction of Brussels in the shape of the EU Mortgage Directive. Can you explain how that applies to buy-to-let London?
Yes, so the Brussels Directive is all about whether regulators should protect those people who are not professional landlords, but perhaps maybe inherit a house, but the National Landlords Association and many lenders I've spoken to say that it's very hard to draw a firm distinction between professional landlords who might have a dozen or more properties and those who make a deliberate move to keep the house that they're living in and rent out another one. And actually, if this regulation, as interpreted by the Treasury, forces those people who have deliberately made that decision to be able to prove that they can afford to pay the mortgages on both their properties through their own income, not just through a typically interest-only buy-to-let mortgage that is paid for by the rent, then that will be a serious problem for an industry in which 78% of landlords only own one property.
So it sounds like there are quite a few challenges on the horizon. Of course, interest rates may rise next year as well. Mm. On balance, do you think buy-to-let still stacks up as an investment option for people with the time and the money to do it?
I think the message from the industry people that I've spoken to this week is that it is still, perhaps unsurprisingly, a good deal because of these demographic changes that you see. But they are all very clear that you have to do your homework and you have to know where you're buying, who you intend to let to, how much of leeway you can take in terms of voids, which are the times when people are not in the property and paying their rent. and ultimately how much variance you can take on things like interest rates.
Thanks very much, James. We take the temperature of the buy-to-let market in FT Money's cover feature this week. And of course, our databank pages always show you the latest mortgage deals for aspiring landlords. FT Money is part of the Weekend FT, which is widely available on both Saturday and Sunday. You can also read online at ft.com/money or on tablet devices using our new web app. On to our final item for today. In 2008, Natalie Ellis appeared on the BBC Two show Dragon's Den looking for funding to commercialise a non-spilling dog bowl that allows your pooch to drink during a car journey. She was rejected by the Dragons, but her Road Refresher dog bowl went on to be a great success, and her company now has annual sales of over £8 million. We'll be running an interview with Miss Ellis in a coming issue of FT Money, but the whole episode got us thinking about whether there's money to be made from our devotion to pets. After all, almost half of UK households own a pet. Estimates vary, but the Pet Food Manufacturers Association says we spend about £2 billion a year on food alone. On top of that comes vets bills, fees for kennels and catteries, and of course all the pampering and treats, taking total pet spending to well over £5 billion every year. The pet industry is remarkably recession-proof too. During a five-year squeeze on wage growth, consumers have cut back on foreign holidays, meals out and other treats, but not, it seems, on their pets. Adam Palin, who is part owner of a fairly high-maintenance retriever, has been looking at this very issue. Adam, this is an area where there aren't really any funds or collective for investment products available. So we're really talking about investing in individual companies and possibly buying their shares. Are there any big players in the UK in the pets department?
Well, the obvious one is Pets at Home, the supermarket for pet products, if not quite pets. They do have some reptiles and rabbits and fish floating around, but no doggies in the window. They do sell food, accessories, and listed this year. The shares are down about 15% since then, although to an extent that reflects a general downturn in retail. What's interesting about the company is that Pets at Home are moving into services. Now that includes grooming and veterinary practice, which can be in store. The veterinary market is dominated by independents, but through the acquisition of Vets for Pets, in addition to its existing number of in-store vets, it's looking to get around a 10% market share there.
And what about the makers of food for pets? I gather this is a remarkably concentrated market.
Yeah, indeed. Nestle are, in fact, the largest player. According to figures from the American Pet Products Association, they have market share around 48% through their Purina brands. It actually accounted for around 15% of group operating profits in 2013. So it's a large part of the company, a very profitable part. But obviously, if you're buying into Nestle, then it's as much into chocolate and cereals. The other main actor is Mars, who acquired Procter & Gamble's pet care business for around $3 billion this year, although they're a private company.
And what about medicines for pets? I mean, my elderly cat needs arthritis medicine, which costs a fortune. I cannot believe that somebody somewhere isn't making an absolute packet. Who's making money from pet medicine?
Lots of people. I think that every month when I get to apply the advocate to Bell the retriever's head, that's made by Bayer, the German pharma group. Sanofi are another big player. But obviously, if you're investing in those kind of companies, the human pharmaceutical part of their business is much larger, so there's no direct exposure. Now, Pfizer, the US pharmaceutical giant, they spun out their animal health group last year. It's called Zoetis. The shares have done remarkably well this year, up over a third, although, of course, it is US listed. So for UK investors, there is cost there, obviously.
Yes, I mean, that applies to several of the companies you've mentioned there. In the UK, mentioned Pets at Home, are there also smaller and more focused companies that whose shares will be easier for UK investors to buy?
There's one main listed company that comes up called Dechra. They used to have a big distribution arm, but they got rid of that last year. Now they're purely pharmaceutical. An area where they specialise is in endocrinology products for cats and dogs. Again, they've done really well. The last 3 years, their shares have doubled, and that's mainly due to this specialisation and also expansion into Europe and the US.
And finally, if you don't want to sort of become a stock market investor and you don't want to buy shares in overseas companies, you could, I guess, do no worse than become a pet sitter. Apparently, this is an enormous growth market.
Well, so I'm told, and on my dog walks, I do see a number of apparently self-employed or franchised dog walkers. The extent to which they are verified and approved is, of course, debatable. It's self-regulated, but there's certainly one association, the National Association of Pet Sitters and Dog Walkers, who I spoke to. Now, they're 750 or so members. They have to be insured. They only walk their dogs in small groups and so forth. The idea being that that offers dog owners a degree of comfort that their dog's being well looked after. But for most people doing this, it's a part-time job. Many are retired. But in some cities, I know in London, hourly rates can be around £20 a dog, but it's still very much in a nascent form.
£20 an hour to walk a dog when we pay people in care homes the minimum wage. Something's gone wrong with Britain, I feel, but there's lots of money to be made from pets. Thank you very much. And there's lots more about the amazingly profitable pet business in this weekend's FT Money. What else do we have? Well, my column takes a look at what might be in store in next week's autumn statement. Ken Fisher explains more fascinating correlations between US elections and stock markets. We look at commercial property funds, the latest changes to the rules governing how people can take their pensions. And we've also a story on how Terry Venables' nascent football fund has been showed a red card by regulators in the Caribbean. The Money Show will be back next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, James, Adam, and Jane Tully from Money Advice Trust.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.